Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Priskindas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames in central Iowa, at the heart of it all. Yes, it is. And thanks for joining us today. We get by at this radio station with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Danilana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. Anyway, they are going to have a lot of Christmas things coming up, and we will let you know about that. Otherwise, you can just go on down to the Mucky Duck Pub and pop in for a pint. Ask for Marcus.
Very good. Very good. It snowed. Here it is. It's not even Halloween yet, and it snowed.
The frost was on the pumpkin.
It was. Just in time for all the kids to wear their winter coats over their Halloween costumes this week. Oh, well.
You never know. I can remember Halloweens where we were out drinking cocktails on the front porch while the kids were coming by, right?
Right.
So, in our shirt sleeves. So, this year, it's cold and wet.
It's cold and wet. The snow was very, very pretty.
It was pretty. Because it's not lasting.
It's melting. I think it's supposed to snow again tonight. Okay. Today on the Danilana Kitchen, we're going to talk about pumpkins, squash, sweet potatoes. Don's got a little bit of news, and we've got some events around town to get you up on. You went to an Iowa State University lecture last night, and it was a man and a book that you might want to talk about. So go ahead.
Well, first of all, I want to remind all of you that we do have this large institution, which brings a lot of cultural options. Some of them are, authors of books. So I do watch the ISU lecture series because they are free and open to the public. And last night was not many people attended, I must say, but it was really interesting. It was a man named Rob Nixon, who's, I think, a South African, has that charming accent. But he's a professor at Princeton, part of a environmental think tank there. He also writes for, I believe, the New Yorker, the New York Times. So quite well-spoken, thoughtful man. His last book is called Slow Violence. And basically the idea of the book is about how the environmental catastrophes that are beginning and already happening are affecting third world countries, particularly in a band around the middle of the earth in the hot, hot zones, more disproportionately. They're getting the fuzzy end of the lollipop a lot faster than some of us other people are. And so the topic last night was about environmental martyrs. And he put up a map of the globe and showed the countries where the most people have been actually killed for doing, rainforest preservation and protecting trees. And they went into the typical tree hugger kind of thing. And he talked about, I think her name was Berta Cáceres, who was given the Goldman Prize and then killed within 6 months. Was she in El Salvador? I could be wrong on the details, but anyway, there's her and there's, a whole slew of people that have been killed defending their local environment and the traditional economies that they represent. So he was talking about environmental martyrs, and then he got into all kinds of other things that his job basically is, I think, kind of science writing, but really to help scientists sort of humanize and understand the cultural effects of their normal scientific process. Everything is connected to everything else. So, and he was saying, because I had my friend Walter Anderson with me, who's a physicist, and he was saying, well, what do we do? The speaker, Rob Nixon, was saying, well, as scientists have been finding out, particularly the ones that are working on climate change, as they have been ignored, refuted, and he did point out that is probably worse in this country than anywhere else, that scientists who are used to being accepted and not challenged because science is science. You know, this proves it's true, and how frustrating that's been, and how they've had to reach out into more cultural communicative ways to get their work, have it presented in meaningful platforms for to be used, right? And one of the slides he was showing, it said neoliberals and the numinous. So he was kind of talking about the bridges between how political systems affect our spiritual and psychological and emotional health. And it was a really, really brilliant talk. The book again is Slow Violence, Rob Nixon, and keep your eye on those ISU lecture, the calendars. It's a wonderful opportunity that for a town this size, we have a lot of platforms, thoughtful places to kind of learn, fulfill ourselves, you know, think bigger pictures, things like that. And we're grateful for the university to provide that opportunity to the community for free.
Thank you, Donna. Good report. That sounds like it's worth looking into. I have a small news item here, and this is a place that people have been talking about, or some people have, and now it's open. The Lockwood Cafe on the northwest edge of town is open. Lockwood Cafe, that is on Reliable Street. Yes, you can find it. Take North Dakota, north out of town, just before you cross the railroad tracks. Look to your left, and there is an old grain elevator
there.
Can't
miss it.
Grain elevator, you know, like this big, tall building. In the bottom of that is this little place called the Lockwood Cafe.
And
she serves
crepes. Now she has a couple of crepe griddles, and she definitely, you know, so you don't just get really good coffee there. She has Morning Bell coffee, and she has crepes. And I've heard, and I'm going there for one, that she also has buckwheat crepes.
And there, see, people kind of ask about this, and there's this rumor. There is a rumor that there are truffles to be had out there.
Chocolate truffles.
So. Whoa. So, like I said, it's on Reliable Street. Actually, where Reliable Street and North Dakota Avenue on the northwest corner of town, right before the railroad tracks. That
and
is Lockwood
she's open
Cafe.
From 6:30 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. True coffee
yes.
shop style. Closed Sundays and Mondays.
Very
so
good.
Don't forget that. Give Sharon a shout out. She's done a marvelous job to bring us a little cafe in that corner of town with really good, a lot of it's locally sourced, the food. Lovely lady. We've had her on the show a number of times.
Yes, good. The Lockwood Cafe. Ah, it is getting to be that season, Donna. Let's talk pumpkins. And to start talking about pumpkins, I pulled a big fat book off my shelf, written by a food writer named Nigel Slater.
An English fellow. And a good writer. We love his cookbooks.
I mean, he does do recipes too, but the stuff he writes in between is really nice. So this is him talking about pumpkins and other winter squash. Nigel Slater. I would grow a pumpkin even if it weren't edible. Few things are more beautiful when the morning fog swirls around the damp of the allotments. But the real point of winter squash is the sweetness of its flesh. Only corn on the cob comes anywhere close. Their frugality should not be underestimated. You can get a soup, stew of haricot beans, late tomatoes and cheese out of one for a cheap and filling supper. Half a small one will make enough for a simple soup of four. A thick wedge is enough per person as a side vegetable. I tuck chunks of mine under roast beef so that the sugary fish picks up the deep, savory goo that collects under the meat. Together, they make a tantalizing forkful. Ah, that's a little bit to get your appetite wet for pumpkins and squash. Donna, what do you have
well,
to say about
Well, first of all, I want to
squash.
Point out that most of the pumpkins that are grown around here are meant for jack-o'-lanterns and are not necessarily deeply flavored and worth bothering to cook. That's not true. There are, like, pie pumpkins, or some people call them sugar pumpkins, and they have a little bit more flavoring. But, you know, if you see those big old pumpkin piles sitting out in front of some of the local grocery stores, I mean, I'm sure if you were really, really hungry, you could eat them, but might not have the depth of flavor that would be pleasing. So there are pumpkins and there are squash.
And they're all of the same family.
Yes. So the winter squash, butternut, butternut, which is not shaped like a pumpkin, is very common, and that's really good for using for soups and things like that.
It's sort of the one that sort of looks like a large peanut.
But even better, my favorites are more the some of them are orange and some of them are dark green, but they look like small pumpkins. Sometimes they're called kabocha, K-A-B-O-C-H-A. Sometimes they're called buttercup. Not butternut, but those I think have the best depth of flavor. In fact, when I make pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving and other occasions, I actually make it with the squash because those buttercup squashes have really just a yummy candy flavor. So for desserts, those are wonderful. They're also really good for soups. I've made two squash soups already. I made one with brown butter sage. They take all kinds of flavoring. So you can go Thai flavored with them if you put a coconut milk base and the appropriate spices. There's lots to be said for squash. It's one of my favorite vegetables. Full of beta carotene, by the way.
Yes, I have a question. We usually bake the squash, bake it somehow or other, cut it open, bake it. Skin up or skin down?
I do the skin down so it's like a cup because then all of the juices roast and roll into themselves instead of out onto your baking pan. Also for soups, you can just throw them in a big old pot with water and then steam them and use the water, as the soup stock as well.
Oh, I've never done that. That's good. I always bake mine first and actually fill the oven and bake it, bake. And then what I don't use right away, I put in little freezer bags and they show up for lots of different things later. A little dollop of cooked squash is handy in a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah. It's like a potato. You can use it as a thickener, but it adds a little sweetness to it and a little color. The other thing that is really good right now are sweet potatoes.
Ah.
And in lots of recipes, they're very interchangeable. You can make a sweet potato pie or a pumpkin pie. You can roast sweet potatoes the same way you roast pumpkins. They have different flavors for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But and there are different kinds of sweet potatoes. Lana, which ones have you grown?
Well, I'm not a big sweet potato grower, but around here, there's a variety called Beauregard, and that's
what we call our standard sweet
potato,
right? Well,
around here, that seems to grow well around here, and I also have grown the one called Jewel. It's just, I'm not a sweet potato expert, but those two I have tried before, and those are orange fleshed. There's all kinds. There's white ones.
Right.
And purple ones.
There is these distinctions, and I'm not sure I have this correct, but there are yams and there are sweet potatoes. And if you're from the South, apparently sweet potatoes are very light in color on the inside, kind of light mm-hmm. yellow. And that is a true sweet potato, mm-hmm. according to Southerners. And that the more orange ones are considered yams. I could be wrong about this.
There is this controversy.
It probably changes in place. And then sometimes I see in the stores around here the purple ones, beautiful color for cooking, right?
Those are lovely. I had a friend brought over a purple sweet potato pie, like a pumpkin pie. And yes, it was purple. I was sure that was going to taste just like grapes, but it did not. It did not. That was a sweet potato
pie. Yeah, it's one of those few. There are purple vegetables, and when you cook them, they turn green, But these purple sweet potatoes do add that color component that is truly brilliant. And then there's also another kind is the Japanese sweet potato, they are rather chestnutty almost in their flavor, and they're light yellow. So there's lots of kinds of sweet potatoes, and in terms of texture, they're fairly interchangeable. Slight flavor variations, but they all do the potato flake and the and sweet potato soup is another thing that you can make.
Yes. Now pumpkin and squash, they're kind of the same family. They grow as lumpy things on top of the ground attached to big vines. Sweet potatoes also put up vines, but they all grow underground. They're tubers, and they're really
they're
lovely.
They're potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. And they've got these long running vines, very frost intolerant. So they need a long hot season to grow, and do not leave them in the ground. If you haven't got your sweet potatoes out by now, they're goners. I'm sorry. They freeze really, really quickly. Even if you say, oh, they're underground, they'll last. No, no, no. They're real touchy.
Well, but they're
way.
In the markets now because they people are, yeah. have dug
they have
them
harvested.
Up and they,
yep.
they do store well. I store mine in the downstairs refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
But, yeah, so it's sweet potato, pumpkin, and squash season.
It is. And way back in the middle of the summer, if your sweet potatoes are growing, you can actually harvest the leaves. The leaves are really spinach-like.
I thought so. You
eat
sweet potato vines. Yeah.
You don't eat squash vines. They're pickly and picky and big. And no, we don't. I have some pumpkin and squash ideas here. I often click on a website called permies.com. It's a permaculture bunch of people that just send in all kinds of stuff, and they have topics. And they were, well, so what are we doing with all these pumpkins and squash, they say. So people were sending in advice. And this is not recipes. It's just some advice, okay? You can actually grate pumpkins and squash raw and use it in coleslaws in place of carrots, huh? You could
you don't make a whole coleslaw out of this.
No.
It's an addition to your usual coleslaw.
Crunchy bits in place of carrots, yes, okay? You can replace mashed pumpkin or squash on pizza or replace a tomato sauce on a pizza. Add some sage. A pumpkin sage pizza. Does that sound good?
If you put cheese on it and crust underneath it, you can probably eat just about anything,
That's good. That's good. But, other things, filling
it's an
pasta.
Adult pizza.
Yeah. Filling ravioli with it if you want to get
true.
Fussy.
That's true.
Okay. You can do chunks of pumpkin or squash, bacon, leeks, onions, salt and pepper, olive oil. You can bake that. Baked fall vegetables this time of year are lovely.
Well, you could also pre-bake the squash, cut it into cubes, and put it in a stir fry. It has to be cooked first.
Yeah. If you make a lot ahead of time and have little bags of or little containers in your freezer, you can unthaw that and add it to cornbread, quick breads, or pancakes.
But, I find if I roast at least one squash, and because it can sit in the refrigerator for like a week, and you can keep using it in different things as you go. So you have something already ready to, heat up and serve. So mine don't even make it to the freezer.
That's true. It's just a good thing as a side or as an addition. And here's a kind of a nice pumpkin pie idea. Pumpkin, and like Donna says, you can make it out of pumpkins. You can make it out of squash. Make your crust out of ginger snap cookies. Crush them up and mix them with a little butter. Now, that sounds good. Ginger snap cookies and pumpkin.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of a pumpkin or squash cheesecake with a ginger snap crust.
Here we go. Are we getting hungry here?
Yeah, are we working up to the holidays or what?
Right,
yeah.
Right. Also, I want to remind you, some people really like the pumpkin seeds. So I noticed we had Jennifer Knox, the purveyor of the salt liquor version of seasoned salts here in central Iowa, salt liquors. And she has a website called salt-liquors.com. Mm-hmm. And this week, she had this big headline, don't throw away the seeds when you make your jack-o'-lantern. Save those seeds. And put some salt, guess what, on them and a little oil and roast them in the oven.
It's true that probably the seeds taste better than the jack-o'-lantern itself.
Probably true.
Or especially when I'm doing squash, I do throw the seeds out into the bush because the little critters really, really eat them.
Yeah, you can share.
Keep it out of the garbage and just put it out for the critters.
I like that. I like that. I didn't do any Halloween pumpkin carving this year. I painted some things. I put some eyeballs on some squash and I saw a really good idea. Instead of bothering to do a pumpkin. This a crafter or whoever in on, she just got some plastic mice and some rubber snakes and kind of wrapped those around the pumpkins, and that was good. You know, I mean, I think that's
oh,
good.
I think I'll put some plastic snakes in my around my mailbox post,
yeah, that's
right?
That's Halloweenish. I like that. So don't throw away those seeds and think about pumpkins and sweet potatoes and squash. Here's another little bit of advice from Nigel Slater, the really one of my favorite food writers. I'm reading from a big tome of his called Tender, Volume 1, A Cook and His Vegetable Patch. It's a big, heavy book, and my dog actually chewed on it a little bit here, so it must be good. But anyway, here is something called Putting the Knife in, A Word of Caution. Sometimes the skin is so hard of it when you're cooking, when you're dealing with a pumpkin.
Pumpkin,
you feel a need for an axe. These old fruits are not called iron barks for nothing. I cannot overemphasize the need for great care when breaking open your giant purchase, particularly if it has a smooth skin that might give it tendency to slide. Put the creature down on the work surface and cut a slice from the base so it will stand firm. Then peel by cutting downwards toward the board if you need to peel it. You can trim up any missing bits later. Slice in half, scoop out the seeds and fibers with a spoon or your fingers. You can toast the seeds if you feel the need for something to crunch on between your teeth. You'll need some salt and a cold beer to go with this. Cut the deep orange meat into slices, chunks, or dice, or whatever your recipe demands. Not that mine ever demand anything. They merely suggest. The density and color of squash's flesh dictates how your supper will turn out. Pale, easy-to-cut squash makes a sloppy mass and sometimes a weak soup. Dense, brightly colored flesh will produce a mash with a backbone and a stew or curry whose principal ingredient hasn't melted to slush, albeit a beautiful one. The harder your pumpkin is to cut, the sweeter and firmer its flesh, usually.
Yes, absolutely.
And the more body and bite to your supper. I do not despise the pale flesh of acorn squash, but bake it instead. The heat of the oven concentrating it is sometimes worth the flavor. There you go. So putting the knife in, a word of caution, be careful out there. You've often mentioned, Donna, that being a chef, you're dealing with fire and knives. It's hard.
Well, yes, being a chef, I try to avoid peeling my hard squashes. So there are a few instances where you want to do it, but not very many. My best tip is to cook it in its skin and then peel it, because once it's cooked, you can either scrape the squash out, or if you actually need chunks, it's a lot easier to peel it from the outside once it's cooked. So I very rarely peel it when it's raw.
Very good. Squash and pumpkins.
Because he's right. It's hard. Your knife will slip. It's a lot of work.
Ah, be careful out there.
And one of the reasons the jack-o'-lanterns that people buy have so little flavor is because they're growing these to be soft enough to carve easily.
There you go. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking pumpkins and squash today, and we will talk about more about pumpkins and squash later in the show. But first, we have something from the Donna Lana Kitchen News Department. Donna, what do you have for us?
Well, this is not a breaking news story, but it is an ongoing news story about the USDA moving the Economic Research Service away from Washington, D.C., and actually, I think it was two departments. But so the Washington Post about a week ago had an article written by somebody named Andrew Crane Droesch, G-R-O-E-S-C-H, and he's now a data scientist at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, but he worked as a research economist at the ERS and in the USDA between 2016 and 2019. So he's commenting on this move.
The idea of moving the USDA is moving?
Big parts of the USDA have been moved out of Washington, D.C. So in the article he says, the Secretary of Ag claimed that moving the service would lower costs and bring us closer to, quote, stakeholders. And he says that stated justification was a fig leaf for the administration's true intentions. He says, we didn't need to sit next to a cornfield to analyze agricultural policy. Purdue knew that. He just wanted researchers to quit their job.
And is that happening?
Yes. It has been a major downsizing. They unionized. There are still, I know that the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Farmers Union and other fairly major organizations are still lobbying Congress to counteract that because he goes on to describe what goes on there because, you know, most people don't really understand what the ERS does. You know, he says, he talks about himself at the ERS. I was one of the very few people in government who knew how to apply machine learning tools to problems of agriculture and climate change. And I had colleagues who had honed even more arcane backgrounds and skill sets. Now the public will lose the targeted expertise we developed on their behalf. So the statistics coming out of this move, it says, our union estimates that 180 employees who were assigned to of the 180 employees who were assigned to relocate, 141 of them declined. They weren't willing to uproot their families, sacrifice their spouses' careers, or in some cases disrupt their medical treatment to stay at an agency that was doing this. The agency has managed to hire a few sharp new researchers in Kansas City, but they're just a drop in the bucket compared to what's being lost, and it'll take them a long time to learn their fields. He goes on to say, around two-thirds of the ERS positions are currently vacant. With all those seats unfilled, the handful of remaining staff will spend their days buried under policy review requests, too busy putting out the fires to work on challenging new questions. When I joined in 2016, the agency already faced an aging workforce and was poised to rapidly recruit more fresh PhDs. Now, many of its veterans are retiring early before they can pass on their knowledge. That depletion will set the agency back by a decade or more. He finishes by saying, if lawmakers want to know that, so this really explains what we're losing and especially why it should have been in Washington, D.C. If lawmakers want to know about, say, the effects of tariffs on broiler chicken industry or the impact of farm conservation payments on the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, obscure topics that can mean millions of dollars and thousands of jobs, they will be operating in the dark now.
Ooh.
So the statistical research and science behind a lot of legislative decisions is not going to be available.
And this is the stuff about our food systems, our environment, our
things that come out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Farm economy.
And that's a lot of farm bill research that, and for example, the studies that show the impacts of food stamps and the, you know, obviously the food stamps benefit the people who need to eat, but they also benefit the local economies where the food stamps are being spent and things like that.
And the farmers that are growing the food.
That's right. And this can all be calculated so that a clear picture of what's going on. And it's not just some, oh, I think this would be a good idea to put into a law that's going to affect the whole darn country, you know. No, there is research to show, well, if you do this, then that will happen. If you don't do this, that will happen, you know. And so policy decisions can be made on a very rational basis, not just somebody's pet project or their interest or their, oh, wouldn't that be a darn good idea? You know, I mean, because like if we're a, you know, like if a person wants to do something and then it doesn't work out the way they think it's going to, well, it's a small little incident and you have to take personal responsibility.
Live and learn, yes.
Yeah, but when you're guiding large policy implementation, the research is foundational for this sort of thing. So once again, we are losing the rational voices and the science behind these things through what usually is, you know, corporate downsizing. Everybody knows about it, but we are applying those principles to the government in ways that may come back to bite us, you know?
We seem to be applying that to scientific knowledge. Like, we're going to save money by not using this stuff.
Yeah, well, some people just don't want to know this stuff, you know?
Okay.
Oh, I have a good idea for a policy that will benefit some of my friends, but, you know, I don't really want to know what the effects of it are.
Oh, dear.
We won't talk to the scientists about it.
So this is about that. Well, I've heard a little bit about this, too. All of the, but a whole lot of ag research that supports our representatives
in Washington are moving to Kansas. Well, but a lot of them aren't moving to Kansas, so there's just not going to be those jobs. I mean, I'm sure eventually people will move to Kansas or people in Kansas will take these jobs. But as he points out in the article, there's a huge body of knowledge that has been lost. It's not a very efficient way to be doing this work.
Harumph.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we'll just leave that not very pleasant thought sitting right there, and we'll get back to some more pumpkin stuff. This is a little bit from the vast Donalena Kitchen archives. I pulled this up from the archives just because I think we need to hear it right about now. Well, when the frost is on the pumpkin, we've heard that phrase every now and then.
Oh, this is certainly something we all grew up with here. But
we haven't had frost on pumpkin yet, but it must be coming, so I thought it'd be nice to think about this sort of thing. That actually comes from a poem written by a poet that was born in Indiana in 1849. His name was James Whitcomb Riley.
And I have to say that all grammar school literary textbooks had this poem in the 50s in the U.S. I remember this one well.
It did. James Whitcomb Riley lived from 1849 to 1916, and he was a friend of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and all that
stuff. Who else was also in all the anthology young folks in those days, too.
Yeah, he was a prominent poet, writer. He went on tours and gave readings. He's very popular as a children's poet, wrote a lot of really nice children's poem, including the poem The Raggedy Man.
And he was known for his, you know, instead of being New England, he was a Midwesterner, and he was a little looser with the vernacular language, as you'll see in the poem.
Right. I suppose that it was considered pretty risque at the time. He used...
Yes, not proper English.
Not proper English. He talked like Midwesterns. And this poem is a delight to the eye, because actually you probably won't hear it, but it is written in vernacular. Actually, pumpkin is PUNKIN. And other stuff in here is, you have to look at it twice to realize what it is, but it sounds just right. Things like that. Another nice thing about, not a nice thing about James Whiscombe Riley, but if you look this nice man up, who was a children's poet and a very popular sort of person, well, he evidently had a little problem with the bottle. So his career as a reader of poetry at children's parties was sort of like nipped in the bud really soon because he had a little problem with that sort of thing. But he was a character, people liked him, and he is well remembered as a poet of Midwestern vernacular and as a children's poet, too. Oh, he also wrote the poem Little Orphan Annie. But since this is fall and we're thinking about harvest, and we use this term whether we know where it came from or not, I'm going to read When the Frost is on the Pumpkin by James Whitcomb Riley. When the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock, and you hear the chuck and gobble of the strutting turkey cock and the clacking of the guineas and the clucking of the hens and the roosters, hallelujah, as he tiptoes on the fence. Oh, then's the time a feller is feeling at his best, when the rising sun to greet him from a night of peaceful rest, and he leaves the house bareheaded and goes out to feed the stock, when the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock. There's something kind of hearty-like about the atmosphere when the heat of summer's over and the cooling fall is here. Of course we miss the flowers and the blossoms on the trees and the mumble of the hummingbirds and buzzing of the bees, but the air's so appetizing and the landscape through the haze of a crisp and sunny morning of the early autumn days is a picture that no painter has the colorin' to mock when the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock. The husky, rusty rustle of the tussles of the corn and the rasping of the tangled leaves as golden as the morn. The stubble in the furrows, kind of lonesome-like, but still a-preaching us sermons to us of barns they growed to fill. The straw stack in the medder and the reaper in the shed, the hosses in their stalls below and the clover overhead. Oh, it sets my heart a-clickin', like the tickin' of the clock, when the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock.
Oh, good one, Lana.
So there's a fall poem, an agricultural fall poem. I wonder...
A Midwestern agricultural fall poem.
Should we explain what fodder's in the shock
yes,
is?
Yes, I think we should.
A shock is...
It's a when you take usually corn, mm-hmm. right? And you make a stand of it and tie them together.
Yeah.
It's a harvesting technique, which we certainly no longer do.
No.
But a shock of corn. You'll see them decoratively at fall harvest
right.
buffets and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. That's the only place you'll see it. Way before big reaping machines. You just cut off the whole stalk and stack a bunch of them together. Actually, there were bundlers even pulled behind horses.
To dry them out, right?
Dry the corn. Mm-hmm. Dry the corn in the field. So if you see these old...
It's kind of gone the way of haystacks, too.
Yeah, haystack. Yeah. Actually, you can shock wheat and oats, too, mm-hmm. in those mm-hmm. small little lumps. Mm-hmm. So a shock is a way of drying
a bundle,
things.
A bundle.
And fodder. Fodder is food for horses and food for animals and, yes, and frost and pumpkin. That's
and the
pumpkin.
Shock is in the fodder.
Yeah, fodder's in the shock.
Oh, the fodder's in the shock.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, something like that. You remember it very well from your school days. And that's Frost is on the Pumpkin, a poem by James Whitcomb Riley, and that's Pumpkin, P-U-N-K-I-N, apostrophe. This is the Donalana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOI 89.1. This is Community Radio, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org, and you can find out more about us there. You can go to the talk section and punch on Donalana Kitchen Show, and you can find past shows. We have everything archived. You can find a picture of us. And there's a recipe page. You could kind of maybe get some ideas for some fall cooking there. We have a pumpkin pie recipe that's kind of worth looking at. So look up the Provençal pumpkin pie recipe. It's kind of good. Was a tune called Pinckney's Jig by Iowa banjo player Bob Black. He lives over in eastern Iowa, I think, in Liberty. West Liberty? It's a little teeny town over by Iowa City. Bob Black is a fine musician, and we'll hear a little bit more about him, a little bit more of his music later. But we're kind of getting hungry here in the studio. We're talking winter food and all those yummy things and pumpkin pie. And, oh, so, Donna, what do you have to say about pumpkin pie?
I had one more pumpkin suggestion. This is an old favorite of mine. Many years ago, I lived in New Mexico for one brilliant winter, and I met a Don Jose from one of the small, you know, older adobe house communities, right? So he had a cookbook of traditional New Mexican recipes, and one of them that has really stuck with me is you take a good, like, kabocha squash or a pumpkin, but it has to be a cooking pumpkin, and you make the little lid on the top, like for a jack-o'-lantern, and then you scoop the seeds out, and then you use it as a vessel. For Don Jose, he filled it with a mixture of New Mexican chilies and, you know, like a good chili sauce, right? And then you put the lid back on, you stick the whole thing in the oven, and you cook it. I also, over the years, have found just putting a marinara sauce in it works really well, too.
Really?
It's nice because then if you're to serve it, you just bring the whole thing to the table and you can actually, you can either dig out of it with the sauce, or you can just split it open in front of everybody and let it, you know, run all over it. A good bolognese with meat sauce is also really good.
That is good. Long, long time ago, back when I was just kind of, you know, a new bride, kind of trying those new joy of cooking books, and I wasn't very good in the kitchen then, but they had this recipe for making soup or something I spent that whole dinner party rather anxious because the thing looked like it was going to explode on the table because it was so done that it just sagged.
They do sometimes.
Yeah. I should have put it in a big bowl as opposed to just worrying about it.
Well, or, you know, you just keep cooking it till when you can open it up and poke the inside. You don't want to poke it too hard because you'll make a hole in it and then it'll start leaking all over. Mm-hmm. But you can poke the lid and figure out. You just want it done till it's kind of soft, like a baked potato kind of feeling.
Ah, very good.
Sometimes I put it like on a bed of rice or quinoa or something so that when you split it, all of the good juicy stuff is, you know, right there on the, goes right into the rice or the, it's really simple to do and a lovely presentation, even just for a weeknight, you know.
Very good. Oh, also, we were, you know, in between songs here. We chat away here in the studio around our kitchen table. Our engineer, Cynthia, said, say, Using ginger in a pumpkin pie might be a good idea.
Fresh ginger.
Oh, fresh ginger.
Yeah, well, pumpkin pies, in that pumpkin pie spice, the one you buy already mixed, there is ginger. There's ginger, cloves, probably allspice, certainly cinnamon. But I tend to spice it myself because, you know, I like my spices really deep and robust and pronounced. And I do use fresh ginger. I use a very fine grater and I grate it right into my pumpkin pie filling. And don't be stingy with it.
Very good. You heard it here first, folks. Yes, this is the season for pumpkin pie, spice, everything. And I'd rather just have it in my pumpkin pie. Thank you. I don't need it in my air freshener. But pumpkin pie spice does, in the lattes and all that kind of, no. But for those that will, it isn't a bad thing. It reminds you of home. It reminds you of all sorts of good things to eat. Oh, very good. Very good. So, have we covered the gamut on
the pumpkin sweet potato squash thing? Yeah, that'll inspire you all to get going on some of these good seasonal produce items.
Very good.
Also very healthy. Oh. Fiber, beta carotene, you know, vitamin A, all that good stuff.
Yum. So this is the week, or this is the time of year, when little kids put on costumes and big kids put on costumes and trick-or-treating, the idea of tormenting your neighbors and asking for treats. It's got a long, long ancient tradition of people scaring away evil spirits and wishing good ones for the coming winter. And everybody's got a different idea of when you should trick-or-treat. Now, since Halloween falls in the middle of the week this year, some cities are having trick-or-treat last weekend, and other cities are having trick-or-treat on the appropriate day. There is a listing in the Ames Tribune, I think it came out last Saturday, as to when and where you should go. If kids in Ames, Iowa, you were supposed to trick-or-treat last Sunday, I believe, October 27th.
Yeah, that's so far in advance, it didn't even happen. Yeah.
Although, you can go to North Grand Mall for their Mall-O-Ween on October 30th. Now, Nevada and Huxley and Colo and Roland and Ziering, Roland and Gilbert and Slater are having theirs on Thursday, October 31st.
Yes, on the appropriate day. Hello, I am kind of old-fashioned. I want my holidays on the days where they're supposed to be.
For some reason, Ziering is having theirs on Friday, November 1st. Maybe that's, I don't know, time to trade off all the candy you didn't like and give it to the kids in Ziering. I don't know. But anyway, trick or treat, and be careful out there. Be careful crossing streets, and be careful of all the people out celebrating. I want to mention, we're kind of into the upcoming things here. We talked earlier about Lockwood Cafe, a fine institution that is now open on the northwest edge of town, and they are having a grand opening. And their grand opening, guess what, is on Halloween evening. Event is from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. on Thursday, October 31st. Wear your costumes. So it is an event made for...
Oh, it's a nighttime event.
Late nighttime. This is Halloween. Stop by. This is good. And also, there's not just the cafe out there. Lindy Nissen, who is also a co-owner of this sort of adventure out there, there's an art gallery out there, too. And there'll be many different things happening. Yes, there is. Here is another upcoming. In that very same space, there will be a fashion show.
But that's not on Halloween.
That's not on Halloween.
This weekend on
November 2nd.
Is that Saturday night?
Saturday evening. And that is early 5:30 and goes into the evening. And you must have tickets for that. And it is a fashion show given by Janae Smith, who is the owner and operator and fine creative person who runs Threaded.
As the apparel architect.
Yes. She's not a seamstress. She's not a tailor. She's an apparel architect. She does tailoring, garment repair, and custom design. So she will have...
On Main Street is where her
little shop is on Main
yes.
Street. Just as cute as a bug. Yes, it is. So if you want more information about the fashion show, and it does require tickets, go to Threadit.com. Facebook.
Threadit.com.
Okay. Yes. Or stop in her little shop at 330 Main Street, and you do need tickets for that event. And that is Saturday evening. Oh, yes, it is.
Right, because I think that Lindsay Nissen, who, this is the Alluvial crew, mm-hmm. when they purchased this old elevator, which is an odd sort of piece of architecture, kind of emblematic, certainly, of our local economy, they envisioned it as a community art space. So there will be shows, gallery shows, and then the coffee shop is there to give you sustenance, and it's a really nice community space. That's the Reliable Street and the Lockwood Cafe.
Yes. Oh, and here is a phone number for more information about the fashion show, 515-996-6994. Also, here's something that always confuses me. Coming up Sunday, November 3rd, Daylight Saving Time ends.
Ends. Right.
Sunday.
We go back to real time.
Oh.
Okay, so fall back means we get an extra hour on Sunday.
Oh, I guess.
Right.
I guess. After we
spring forward, fall back, right?
Oh, all right.
Okay, something like
very
that.
Very hard. That's very, very, very hard.
All just right. Pay attention to your clocks, guys.
Okay. So when you end up way too late for something on Sunday, you'll know why.
No, you'll be early.
You'll be early. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Whew. So that's Daylight Saving Time this coming Sunday. And coming up, local elections, Tuesday, November 5th.
Yes. Vote. What have we got? The school board, city council.
Oh, the permanent other else? Stuff.
Maybe some issues. I don't really know. But for sure, it's school board and city council. Important things for our local, the way we're running things around here. So
yeah.
Inform yourself as to the positions of the candidates and go and vote.
Vote.
It's Tuesday, a week from today.
It's good practice. I hear we have an exciting year coming up as far as the national election is concerned.
Well, yeah, but if we focus all on the national, we tend to forget that the things that most affect our lives are actually happening on the local level. So this is an important election. Make your opinions felt at the voting box, please.
Very good. And beginning November 6th, KHOI Community Radio Fundraiser. Tune in for that and do give us your support. If your ears are listening to this radio station, open up your heart and give us a little bit of cash to keep us going. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon. Or we're repeated at khoifm.org, streaming at Tuesday at 7 p.m. We had music by Bob Black today. And today we talked about pumpkins, sweet potatoes, and the FDA. Oh, dear. Yes, we did. We talked about a lot of good things. The frost definitely is on the pumpkins. Support this fine radio station. And do become a member. It is affordable. You'll do the right thing. It makes you feel
And
good.
All the money stays in our community. It yes. is local, local, local.
Yes.
All about us.
Help us stay on the air. Happy Halloween, everybody. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Cynthia McClure. Eat good food and enjoy life.